Six music.
BBC Radio. Six music documentaries.
Everett, and welcome to a very special one-off edition of The First Time here on Six Music. This is the show where we look at the key pivotal firsts in an artist's career, the songs and the moments that shape their lives. And today's guest is one of the most innovative, eclectic and successful songwriters the UK has ever produced. And it's his refusal to conform to the idea of just being a UK singer-songwriter that's led his career into such interesting directions. He's been in bands including Blur, Gorillaz, The Good, The Bad and The Queen, Rocket Juice and The Moon, and also undertaken album projects like Dr. D and Monkey Journey to the West, both of which were stage shows, and the Marley Music albums and various Africa Express experiments. He's also written and performed with Massive Attack, Bobby Womack, Amadou Mariam, Fatboy Slim, Tony Allen, JJ Doom, Roots Maneuver, Terry Hall, Francois Hardy, Marianne Faithfull, Child of Love, and composer Michael Nyman, as well as writing the soundtrack for films including Ordinary Decent Criminal and Ravenous. Can only be one person, really. My guest this week on The First Time is Damon Albarn. So I sat down with Damon at his West London studios to talk through his whole musical journey so far, maybe stopping off at some of the more unexpected places along the way. And I started by asking him, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
My mum would say that I was interested in music from a very, very young age, having a harmonica in my cot that I liked blowing. So apparently.
Because it was a very musical upbringing you had? Very musical, very eclectic musical.
Yeah, I mean, my parents aren't musicians. I mean, no, I don't think I had a particularly musical. I had quite a visually interesting upbringing, having two sort of artists in the house. But no, I mean, you know, no one played an instrument. I mean, they sang to me as a kid. But no, I don't think I had a particular... No, I'm the only sort of musician in my family, professional musician. Grandma's played the piano and stuff, but nothing exceptional.
Did you have that thing where records were quite...
We didn't have that many records, to be honest with you. No, okay. We had, you know, several Indian Ravi Shankar and ragas and some Middle Eastern Sufi music, a couple of sort of more anthropological African records than anything specific. Had a cassette of Atom Heart Mother.
If I were a swan, I'd be gone. If I were a train, I'd be late.
A cassette of Catch the Ball at Four, Cat Stevens.
Oh, I can't keep it in. I can't keep it in. I've got to let it out. I've got to show the world. World's got to see. See all the love. Love that's in me. I said, why walk alone? Why
Rubber Soul. I think there was a Rolling Stones record. Some Stockhausen. And then a massive amount of 78s, which range from classical to musical to early spirituals to a lot of French, like chanson, Edith Piaf, stuff like that.
Le jour où tu m'as rencontré était un jour triste à mourir et je traînais dans mes pensées. Un chagrin à n'en plus finir. Mais hélas.
So I suppose there's quite a lot of music, yeah. But I never sort of got, when I know people whose parents were like musicians, you know, I don't think I had that kind of. But certainly quite, it was yes I did. The answer is yes. The first record I definitely fell under the spell of was Seasons in the Sun by Terry Jacks. Yeah,
great record,
which was actually has a much grand tradition in the sense it comes from Jacques Brel and that whole era.
Goodbye to you, my trusted friend. We've known each other since we were 9 or 10. Together we've climbed hills and trees, learned of love and ABC, skinned our hearts and skinned our knees. Goodbye, my friend, it's hard to die when all the birds are singing in the sky. Now that the spring is in the air, pretty girls are everywhere. Think of me and I'll be there. We had joy, we had fun, we had seasons in the sun. But the hills that we climbed were just seasons out of time.
What about the first record that you owned that was yours?
I'd like to say it was Combat Rock, but I think
but
I think the week before that I bought Kings of the Wild Frontier. Those two records were my first two records.
Standing on the radiator grill.
Is the Clash where the West London thing comes from? Because there's always been there's a gravitation to West London. In fact, in this new record, there's a reference to
All
Saints Road.
Yes, and Westbourne Grove.
And obviously Under the Westway, and where you geographically are right now. Was the Clash the thing that's brought you to this part of the world then?
I came here originally because my girlfriend at the time, Justine Frischman, lived here. I was living in South East London when I met her, and she had a flat here, which was like, at that point, someone who actually was in a position to own a flat was a superhuman, you know.
Still is sometimes.
Yeah. Well, do you know what I mean? So that's why I came here, because she had her own flat, and that was the beginning of my love affair with this part of London.
Because there's a romance in the way the Clash sing about this part of London.
Yeah, yeah, totally. But I mean, I was sort of felt it was more London, you know, at that time. I wasn't as that savvy, even though I'd grown up in Leytonstone. I'd been out into the darkest Essex for 8 years, and I'd come back as a student and just lived on the sort of the peripheries of London, you know. So coming back and moving in with Justine was really my reintroduction to London life.
First gig, always a big deal. Or first experience of live music, maybe that's a better question. Remember that?
First gig would have been... Yes, slightly embarrassing.
So it's good if it's embarrassing, it's honest.
It was Nick Kershaw at the Ipswich Gaumont.
Wise men say near a tree.
My first gig, and I had to get on the train and go to Ipswich. I actually recently went back with Paul Simonon to Ipswich to see Ken Dodd, which was really was a fun evening.
Was that one of those 3-hour sets that he does?
Yeah, we actually had to leave before the end because we had to catch the last train.
And what do you remember from the Nick Kershaw gig? White denim highlights.
Yeah, he might have been wearing white denim.
Of course he was.
It was my first gig. It was the first time I'd seen the first time I'd seen a pop star in the flesh. The first time was I'd got a chance through a friend of a friend to go and be in the audience at Top of the Pops.
All right, when was that?
You can put a date to it because it was the debut appearance of Funboy Free.
Right.
With Bananarama.
That's a good performance to witness.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you about Terry Hall. I'll ask you about the Specials specifically.
Well, I was at, I'm not, you know, one of my sort of biggest influences when I was that age was the Funboy Free and the Specials. I still adore. Wonderful guy. I can remember exactly what he was wearing.
Go on, what was he wearing?
He was wearing light tan moccasins, no socks, rolled up jeans, quite high, and a burgundy waffle jumper, which I immediately, when I got back home, went to Mr. Byright in the Culver Centre in Colchester and tried to find the sort of the equivalents. I think I got my moccasins in Millets and I found the jumper in Topman or Mr. Byright's, might be Mr. Byright's, and I think I just sort of adapted my jeans. But I mean, you know, the cyclic nature of fashion is that back in the early 80s, we all had drainpipe super skinny jeans.
Yeah, there was that.
And then they sort of went baggy.
From the top first, the pleats first, the baggy pleats, then the bagginess kind of engulfed the whole trouser.
Did you ever have the, this is a little earlier, this is sort of the New Romantic, that sort of brief, I mean, I was briefly a New Romantic, I'd say 3 or 4 weeks I was a New Romantic.
Yeah.
And I had silver two-tone parachute trousers.
Strong.
Purple Tucker boots. Remember Tucker boots? Tucker boots, they were like a suede. They were like sort of Robin Hood boots, weren't they?
Yeah, sort of.
And you rolled them down.
Ruche, is it called?
Yeah.
Where it sort of bunches up a little bit.
And I had a grey and maroon. There's a lot of maroon going on then.
A light grey, fleck, and maroon. Yeah.
I had a maroon crossover shirt.
That pinned up across the shoulder?
Yes.
Classy.
Yeah. There you go. And I think I've peroxide my hair as much as I could with lemon juice.
Blur gig when you were Seymour. What can you remember from it? Can you remember any of that gig? Because looking at footage that is around of those really early shows, it's quite a ferocious proposition.
Yes, it was more about self-harming, really, and being sick than music. It was just full on. It was drink as much as you can before you go on and play as fast as you humanly can until you collapse in exhaustion, really, and then that's it. That's the end of the gig. You know, we didn't really do much more than like 25-30 minutes, but I mean we gave a lot in that in that brief period.
Because watching that, and even on the first record, there's this sort of duality of like, it's a pop band, but it's also almost quite avant-garde. It's very,
yeah, it was,
there's
it
a noise sort of created, and not just on songs like Sing, but on more kind of unhinged songs.
Yeah.
It was the start of, you've always been, Blur have always been an art rock band and a pop band. And even early on, I think you can see that duality.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we started, you know, if you can sort of call it a following, it was the years 1, 2 and 3 from Goldsmiths, and also a couple of other art schools where friends of ours were at. My sister was at Hornsey So there was that art school as well. So that was our following, just pissed art students, which is a good following.
And even as Blur got hugely successful, there's always been this sort of parallel, often really, really difficult element to all your work. And not many bands can do both at the same time. Not many bands can have mainstream success.
Well, I think in a way that sort of put me in good stead for everything I've done subsequently. I mean, you know, I do quite weird stuff like Dr. D, and then I'll do something really mainstream, I don't know, something else.
Ask you about Ravenous. 1999 is your first film soundtrack, if I'm right. I love it. It's an amazing piece.
It wasn't my first film, though. I did a bit of extra stuff apart from the song for Trainspotting. I did the sort of end of the film, the music for the end of the film.
But as a whole piece of work.
Yeah.
It's a really lovely soundtrack.
I think it's getting re-released, actually. Which is nice, because I haven't got a copy of it. And I think they might even put it out on vinyl, which would be brilliant. I'm really proud of that. you know, it was an amazing learning experience for me to work with Michael Nyman. And we got on really well.
That's like 18th century music, isn't it? You're essentially trying to capture that.
To an element of it. Yeah, element. I mean, it's quite a strange film, that.
It's a good movie, actually.
Yeah, it's all right.
Have you always loved that kind of melding of movies and music? Have soundtracks always been really important?
I don't know if I want to do more films or less. I do them from time to time. I really enjoy the process, but it's not something that I've ever really pursued in the sense of, you know.
Why not? It's not like you're lazy.
No, partly it's difficult to find the time to, because you do have to devote a few months. If you're doing a proper score, you can't just knock it out in a couple of days. So it's time consuming. But I've got a few things that because I've worked with some friends now. We call ourselves the Electric Wave Bureau, which comes from a department of the North Korean government, which goes around checking that people can't pick up any foreign and undesirable radio or TV channels. And that's, so I work under that name with some other people, which is, and that's really enjoyable, sort of working with other people on films. Is, you know, it's a collaborative thing, so yeah, I mean, I enjoy doing it, and I hopefully we'll get a chance to do some more.
Blue is where I want to be. When I'm down, I'm in the sea, looking up at monsters in the clouds.
Colours from the soundtrack to the recent film Broken by the Electric Wave Bureau, one of Damon Albarn's many musical projects.
This is Six Music.
This is BBC Radio Six Music.
No camera too.
Welcome back to this very special edition of The First Time here on Six Music. I'm Matt Everett, and today we're looking at the key pivotal firsts in the career of Damon Albarn, the songs and moments that shaped his life. The song you just heard was Tomorrow Comes Today, the first official Gorillaz track from 2000. The group were formed by Damon and artist Jamie Hewlett and would go on to encompass countless famous collaborators and sell a lot of records worldwide. Did you expect it to get as big as it did, Gorillaz? Because it is, arguably, they became a bigger band than Blur.
And sold a lot more records.
It's a different thing, but
it's a totally, yeah, exactly, you can't compare them. And that's why I like doing a solo record. I mean, I thought Gorillaz was me doing a solo record. It's just because I didn't put my name on it, and I sort of collaborated with a lot of people. But, I mean, I wasn't in a band. I was essentially generating all the music in a studio on my own. But do you ever do anything on your own? No, you don't. So when you say, you know, I've got a solo record coming out, I mean, I have, in a sense, it's got my name on it, but I didn't make it on my own.
Because it started off as being quite a sort of self-contained, small thing and very sort of tangible. These images are drawn by him and the music is done by him. And then it became this, became a brand. It became this huge, sprawling, you know, here's 1,000 guests and here's huge concerts. And then...
Yeah. Oh, no, that last tour was... I doubt the world will ever see anything quite like it again, partly because no one would be stupid enough to try and logistically put something like that on the road again, and you don't make any money. We made a lot of money in the sense that we played massive gigs around the whole of the world, but believe you me, when we got the sort of final expenses, outgoings and...
Lou Reed's rider.
No, Lou was, God rest his soul, was really a wonderful person to work with. It's a great feeling when he walks on stage, especially at Madison Square Gardens, because when he walked on stage, it sounded like the whole of the crowd were going boo 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 boo, but they were saying Lou, but with that sort of New York accent, it sounds like they're booing him, but they're not. They're just recognizing one of their own.
Some kind of nature, some kind of soul, some kind of mixture, some kind of gold, some kind of majesty, some chemical load. Some kind of metal made up from glue, some kind of plastic I could wrap around you. Needy eat man-mades, they wear phony clothes. They sit with our picture with them built big.
Some kind of nature, some kind of soul, some kind of mixture, some kind of gold.
Was it quite fun just to kind of ride that and see how far it could go as a project?
You see, it's weird because when is it Gorillaz and when is it not Gorillaz? Is it only when it's got the cartoons? Does that make it Gorillaz? I don't know because for me it's the same. It's always the same process. If I'm in the studio making music, the process is the same.
There's a bigger philosophical question. If a Gorillaz song gets recorded in a forest and nobody sees it, is it
yes.
a Gorillaz track?
That has happened.
2002's Marley Music album was the first time that lots of people were kind of aware that you'd started to get deeply involved in African music. And when you talk about the trip you did with Oxfam just before that, you talk about it so passionately. It seems not just to be like an artistic awakening, but kind of almost a rehabilitation from like a lot of stuff you'd gone before on Blur coming to an end. And you seemed so affected by that first trip.
Yeah, it was an extraordinary thing. I mean, having essentially spent my 20s travelling in a very constrained way, but that felt like my first adventure, if you like.
What do you mean?
Well, in the sense that I felt like I was just myself going somewhere. I wasn't in any kind of bubble or anything. I was just myself. And nobody had any idea or any interest in anything about me. I don't know, I just felt reassuringly invisible, and not that I didn't feel normal, but I felt, I don't know, it just wasn't, there's not a great deal of pressure on you when you turn up somewhere. Comparatively to the, what I'm saying, I'm talking about the previous 10 years where travel had been very organized and very sort of regimented. So it's all an illusion. The whole thing's an illusion. Whereas I felt when I turned up in Mali, what I was seeing was, I was seeing it just as anyone else. I don't know. You see, now I'm going to start getting really tongue-tied and feel sort of awkward talking about how it affected me, because it makes me sound like I had some sort of epiphany, which I suppose I did.
That's fine to say that.
Yeah, like, I know, but it's a bit of a...
It's like, I was just thinking that I was talking, it's like, can you say you kind of went to go and find yourself again, which is the worst thing you can possibly say, but if things are expected of you, you're supposed to be in certain places, people know who you are, then you are kind of going I'm like when I'm not doing that.
A previous attempt to sort of break out of that bubble had been getting on a plane and going to Iceland.
Mm, yeah.
But within 2 days of being there, it became very apparent to me that it wasn't really any different from being here.
Just colder.
It was colder, but people seemed to have exactly the same sort of perception and were as interested in it, the image and the whole bubble aspect of it. Whereas there, no, there was no bubble. I was bubbleless. Day one, I turned up at Tamani Diabate's, who's, I think it's fair to say, the world's greatest kora player. And I mean, within the griot tradition in West Africa, he's considered someone who can summon the voice of God. I mean, he's a revered individual. It's a spiritual responsibility he has when he plays his instrument. So I was kind of sort of had this unbelievable opportunity. I suppose you could say I was still in a bubble, because you don't just get a chance to meet Tamani Diabate. I suppose you could say that, but it didn't feel like that. It just felt really terrifying, because I turned up with my melodica and he had this unbelievable 21 string harp, a kora, and immediately he started playing. And this was my first ever time sort of improvising with someone like that.
A musical deity.
Well, almost, you know. And the thing is that his tuning and my tuning were slightly different, and you can't tune a melodica. I mean, that's the one drawback of it as an instrument. And we weren't in tune. So, you know, there were a lot of reasons. I was really nervous. I was out of tune. I couldn't get my head around with the rhythm he was playing, let alone the mode he was playing in. So it was a very good experience, and I sort of slowly started feeling more comfortable, and the distance between that point and now is immense for me personally, because I've had such amazing opportunities to go all over Africa and play with so many different people. Latterly with Africa Express, met people who were up for helping organise these extraordinary trips that people have been on, because it's not, you don't just suddenly start wearing kind of African print clothes, and you know, it's a bit more subtle than that, but
yeah.
it does as a musician, that there is something very transformative about playing in that kind of environment with something which is still so sort of rooted in a tradition, in an oral tradition.
When did you first meet Tony Allen? because he's a figure who's cropped up in many of your collaborations.
That came out of me really getting into the music of Fela Kuti in the sort of the late 90s, independently of anything else, really. I just was really got into it. And then on the Blur tune Music Is My Radar, I sang a line, Tony Allen Got Me Dancing. And I think someone pointed that out to him, and he invited me to come and do some work on a record he was making at the time.
So it's that way around? I didn't realise. Okay, that's nice.
I did this tune with him called Every Season, and the point where my vocal comes in at that point in my life was a really challenging kind of rhythmic point. You know, I didn't have that feel. I didn't find it very comfortable to come in when I was supposed to come in. So I was really nervous about performing it live, and I had this chance to play with him on this TV show in Paris, which was also had Ibrahim Ferrer on it from Buena Vista Social Club. Now, I did the first part, which was quite straightforward, with Ibrahim. And then there was like a two-hour turnaround for cameras and everything. People who remember the MTV presenter Ray Cokes.
Vaguely.
He was backstage and he bought a bottle of Martinique upright rum. And we started drinking it.
In the two-hour window.
Yeah. And I got really, really drunk. Partly from relief that I got through the first part and nothing had gone wrong. And partly because I was really nervous that I was going to screw up the second part because I wasn't sure about this entry point.
Did you find the pocket? Did you get it right?
No. What happened is... So the moment comes and I screw it up and I can't seem to find it. And I'm too drunk to really get my act together. A post note is that was one of the last times I ever drank before I performed. I did eventually learn my lesson, and I never drink before I go on stage ever, ever, ever now. I do drink afterwards, but not before. Anyway, I got so embarrassed that I was screwed this song. I don't know, this is the behaviour of a man who doesn't really know where he is anymore, that I went round to the back of Tony and sort of, like, got on the back of his chair and put my arms around him as he was playing and sort of fell asleep on the drum stool holding him, and he just was totally cool with it and continued playing
playing
the rest of the gig with me, just like till I eventually left. I don't remember anything else for even. I woke up in the morning and tour manager knocked on the door, and I had it go. Hoping for a glimmer of like reassurance in his eyes, but he just looked at me and it was just, dearie, dearie me, that wasn't good, Damon. And I said, well, and, you know, and then suddenly it all started coming back to me. But the point of that story is that Tony was really amazingly good natured about it, and for some reason didn't seem to have a big problem with it, you know. And the fact that he was prepared to be so forgiving, you know, he's been my dear, 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 dear friend ever since.
Some of us are gonna be slide. Some of us are gonna be slide. Some of us are gonna be slide. I got all my weapons.
penny farthing, riding on guitar strings, hoping on a rainbow, wishing for my ego. Target practice, reaching my free fall, landing over people, every limb is lethal. Super radar, double glazed razor, speak yes I may sir, we reflect data. Every season, part of me is leaving, I don't know the reason, memories are freezing. Chilly like the evening, tasty if you need them, sweeter than your freedom, if you like my words then heed them. Fate helps me carry on, blood runs my marathon, veins made of parables and paragons I travel on. I alter lives, to quarter past, free as the ship sails a quarter mast. I'm sort of lost, but first to ask, my starships are searching for my autograph.
Where does this restlessness come from? Because you, be it Dr. D or Monkey Jenny to the West, there is this sense of movement all the time. Is this... because not all musicians have it, not all artists have it. You're quite unique in the...
I don't think I'm unique at all.
Range of projects and the difference that they do in those different...
I mean, as I saw an interview with Steve McQueen, who I admire enormously, Mark Kermode was sort of... asking me if he now considered himself more a director than an artist. And he said, it's just all stuff. I have exactly the same answer. I just do stuff. I do stuff. Stuff inspires me there, and stuff inspires me there, and I just, like, get on with it. I suppose there is an element of hat changing, but in a way it's not. It's all the same thing. I mean, I spent today talking with some people I'm going to be working with on a sort of version of a very classic story. I was in North Korea, and that's going to inform it. So I was talking about that, and we were talking about cosmology, and what else we've been talking about today?
It's just stuff.
You know what I mean? It's like just another day of stuff.
Everyday Robots is the new album. You've talked about this being the most personal record that you've written lyrically.
I think that's in part due to Richard Russell's influence, in the sense that when we were like co-producing the Bobby Womack record, Bobby has one of those voices which just whatever he's singing, it feels very, very intimate and very personal. And then when we finished that record, we were sort of felt like, well, we still want to work with each other. And when you want to work with someone, it's probably a good idea to continue until that magic disappears.
Stops.
Yeah, stops. And so we sort of played around with the idea of starting a new band, you know, just even came up with some stupid names.
Which were? Oh, come on.
No, I might use them in the future.
You might use them in the future. Is it a positive album? There seems to be songs about...
It's positive in the sense that it was cathartic.
Cathartic. Songs about impermanence. It's quite introspective. Was it a hard record to write, Damon?
It was a hard record to write. It was really difficult because, you know, you got that fine balance between becoming too introspective.
Or just personal to you and no one else.
Exactly. But at the same time, I didn't want to make it too universal. I wanted it to keep that sort of integrity, which I feel was important. For me to sing the songs, they need to have that balance. And that was hard to find that balance. But, you know, I'm really proud of the results. And I love singing the songs.
Will this be an ongoing... we've kind of blurred the lines of what's solo, no pun intended. Anyway, but is this relationship with Richard, as Damon Albarn, he says, doing flying inverted commas,
yes,
going to continue? Yes. You see, that's the good thing about radio, is people can't see you doing tossy things like that.
Yes, I would say so. I just like writing songs. I love writing songs.
And doing stuff.
And doing stuff, yeah.
What's the final song we should play? You get to choose it. The song you should think we should finish the programme with. It can be one of yours, it can be one of someone else's, it can be something
you've loved. Well, it's your radio show, let you choose.
You're the guest.
Yeah, but it's your show, so you choose.
I like Black Book, because it's one of the ones that doesn't get played a lot, and I think the choir on the end of it is amazing.
Okay, yeah, if you like that song, play that song.
Or you could suggest something instead.
No, I'm cool with that. It's your show.
I've been doing this for years and no one's ever said me pick a song.
No, so it's your show.
Thanks for speaking to me, man.
My pleasure.
Put away my black book. Put it on the fire. Don't give up on me, Lord. Take my spirit higher.
This is
Six Music.
The sky of the blue.
is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Right now.
This is the Morning After Mix.
You're about to hear a shortened version of the Morning After Mix, a carefully curated playlist available in the BBC Sounds app. It's full of gentle songs for when you need a musical rescue or escape. To find the full version, just search Morning After in the app. But for now, enjoy the calm.